Welcome to Post-Traumatic Thriving, where we explore life's toughest issues along with the art, science, and stories of resilience. Please be advised that our guests share their raw stories of addiction, abuse, crime, and tragedy, along with tips to survive and thrive. And now, here is our host, Dr. Randall Bell.
Welcome back to Post-Traumatic Thriving. I'm Dr. Randall Bell. I am here with Susanna Anderson, the author of this book, You Make Your Path by Walking, where she discusses getting back on her feet and the process of dealing with having been married to David, who tragically one day she found had died from suicide. Unbelievable and surreal as that experience must have been. And then 2 days later, attending a grand event where her husband David had introduced the bride and groom, and Suzanne decided to attend that wedding, which again must have been a near out of body experience, you know, surreal. And so welcome back, Susan. We're glad you're here.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm enjoying this conversation with you. Appreciating it.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, me too. And so I guess the first question I'm guessing on anyone's mind, considering what you've been through, and of course, you grew up in a sounds like an incredible family where your dad's the president of a university and you're speaking multiple languages and you're working in Canada and also in Europe. And then you meet this gentleman, David, and he has this incredible business importing items. And yet there's some financial difficulties going on behind the scenes with the various projects he's working on. And then just the utter shock of that day involving his suicide. What is going on in your mind the day after the wedding where you can really kind of face this new reality? What was that like, the best you can describe it?
Well, you know, so one of the metaphors I've used for this is like an iceberg just cleaving away. You're left standing on the edge of this abyss. That's like the land you had in front of you is gone, and there's just nothing there. So this enormous kind of taking in where I really was. Mm-hmm. I think that early on, a profound thing happened that I write about in the book, which is one of my friends and a writer himself, Michael Mead, who's written a number of books in speaking about these times and fate and destiny and all of this. But I had just seen him recently at an event where he was told me about working with the high school around a suicide that had happened. And so maybe the day after, 2 days after, no, I think it was the next day after David died, I asked him to come over, and he came over. And I was able to talk with him, and I was hoping he'd have some insight about how could somebody do this. I mean, help me understand what this is. And he did something really important for me. There's a myth, and I don't know if you know the Greek myth of Persephone and Demeter. Are you aware of that myth?
I've heard of it, but way beyond me.
Right. Okay. Well, the Greek myth, this particular myth, is that Persephone is the innocent maiden. She's collecting flowers. Hades, the god of the underworld, sees her, falls in love with her, and wants her for his bride, and ends up at some point, you know, the earth opens up and he rides on his chariot and grabs her and takes her into the underworld. And then she has this time in the underworld where she resists all of this, and eventually Zeus, who's the god, the over god, so to speak, says that she must be released, and he sends Hermes to bring her back to her mother, Demeter. And just before she leaves, she's offered these pomegranate seeds. You maybe remember that part. possibly. Anyway, she eats these pomegranate seeds in the underworld. And because she does that, when she returns to the upper world, she is told that she must spend 6 months in the underworld and 6 months in the upper world now, going forward. Well, ultimately, she falls in love with Hades. She's queen of the underworld and queen of the upper world. Okay, so that's the really, you know, short version of the myth. But I've been using this myth for years in my programs, the work that I do with women in leadership. Mm-hmm. And I do a ritual with them where I take them, you know, into the underworld, so to speak, or into their embodied experience, into their feelings, into all of that. And so this is all to set the stage for what happens here, because Michael, who's also a mythologist, knew that we had talked many times about this myth. And he said to me, Suzanne, this is the biggest Hades grab you will ever have. And you are going to be taken down and you are going to go very deep into the dark and you will go deeper than you've ever gone before. But you know how to do this. You are Queen Persephone. Mm. And we will be in the upper world waiting for you. And you go and do what you need to do. And in that moment, I remember the feeling like, okay, this is my destiny. I have to accept this. I surrender to this. And I remember that feeling of just saying, I will go on this journey. And although I do not know how it will unfold, or even if I will get through it, I really had lost all sense of that certainty. But I was absolutely certain that I would go in what I call this way of the mysterial woman. That was the first book. You know, I would go in that way of being that, you know, is the way of being I've been teaching and working with and for 10 years.
Mm. Yeah. Greek mythology is lots of gods, lots of planets, lots of goddesses. It's interesting you kind of landed on that metaphor to work through, certainly a very low point in your life.
And well, the thing about a good myth are the myths that endure through time. Mm. In other words, there's like the bones of a good myth is pointing somewhere, and the mythic is also a great way for the conscious and the unconscious to communicate, because there are symbols involved. And so I think that particular myth, there are other descent myths, but that was a very powerful one for me.
Yeah, for sure. So it sounds like that metaphor was right on the money in terms of you descending into some dark places. What was that like for you?
Well, the biggest piece of that, I think, would be to say, as much as I could, to not resist what was, right? Because there is this natural wanting to climb out of the dark. Like, this can't be real. This can't be happening. This can't be happening to me. This is impossible. And really, it felt like that. Like, my ego identity, and I helped other people going through difficult things. You know, I lived in this incredibly blessed life, in this absolutely beautiful place with a beloved husband who had, you know, finally found. And, you know, I, like, this wasn't me. This just couldn't be happening to me. And there's the suffering, and then there's what's sometimes called the suffering of the suffering. And the suffering of the suffering for me was just resisting, right? Was just resisting this is happening. So that was the first biggest thing, was just like, no, this is happening to me. And I do need everything that I've, you know, I need to call on everything that I've built in my self up until now.
Yeah. I correct me if you think I'm wrong, but the way you described it sounds kind of like the denial stage a little bit. Is that?
That's exactly right. That, and you know, it is a natural stage. There's nothing wrong with the denial stage, because it's a way that we handle, as you well know, trauma. Our nervous system just can't take it all in. So
exactly.
Denial is helpful. But staying there too long was not going to be helpful. You know, in other words, to be there's a natural way in which some of that engages. But also, let's remember, I had his house of cards coming down all around me.
Yeah.
I mean, I lost absolutely everything. So it wasn't, just that I could then slowly make my way through the trauma. I actually was surrounded by this collapsed house and many, many things that I was going to have to actually be present for and attend to. Now, one thing that trauma does do, as you also know, is, and I knew this already because the work I do and did for years with women was around developmental trauma. So that I know something about this, but now I'm like living it full on, which is the prefrontal cortex just wants to, whoa, bye-bye, can't really take in all these details and organize stuff. And I actually had to do that. You know, I had things that had to be attended to.
Yeah.
So it was really important for me as much as I could to, well, I brought others in, of course, to help. That was a big piece of it, and we can talk about that. But I really couldn't be in denial. That wasn't going to be very helpful for me for very long.
I hear you loud and clear, and you put all of that very, very well. This is kind of a pause and teaching moment, if you will, for our audience. Is you hit a whole number of things there. Number one is that denial or anger or depression or shock are all the process of trauma. They're all normal. They're all okay. You just don't want to hurt somebody and hurt yourself, but they're all normal. You talked about the human brain. When, right now we're using our outer human brain. We're using Aristotle, egos, logos, and pathos. We're, logic and emotion and ethics are the human brain. But when trauma hits, that outer brain turns off and it goes to our inner, some call it a reptilian brain, where the amygdala, where we're processing it, and you can only take so much. And that's nature's way of protecting us from being utterly overwhelmed by the horrific nature of what's going on. And the other point you hit on is, well, it's okay. In fact, it's normal. It's healthy to visit anger or denial or depression or the shock, and bargaining is another one. Whether you bargain with God or bargain with the doctors or whoever you're trying to convince to alter the reality, it's all normal. But you made a great point. You just don't want to get there too long. The rule of thumb is that I've heard is in depression or any of these stages, 1 to 3 months max. After that, it's really important to reach out for some help. So does that reconcile with your experience?
It absolutely does. And I would say, I think the reaching out for help has to happen really early.
Yeah.
I mean, don't wait for that, because that was one of the main factors, I would say, that was vital for my own soothing during this, because I had an incredible surround of close friends, women that had been with me for years. My family took turns coming from all over the world for a week at a time to be present with me. And I just opened my arms to all that could be coming around me, because especially in a suicide situation, the shame, as I mentioned before, can be so overwhelming, and there can be the tendency to isolate or to be alone with it. And you want to be, and I wanted to be, and I knew this just in terms of the neuroscience of it, I wanted to be in a, where my limbic system could relax, like that there was a love field. You know, we're like tuning forks. So we're going to attune to whatever's there. And if you've just got trauma around you, or you've just got your own trauma around you, or everyone else's anger, then that's very hard. Yeah. And one of the things I did, I think I might just share early on, was it was probably 2 weeks out from the event. I had Michael Mead again, who does these beautiful rituals. I asked him if he would help me hold an event at my house. Mm-hmm. And this was just inviting all of the closest in of the family and friends and so on. And we used a number of different processes, but the point of it was to be with what is. Like, you know, this was the opportunity here for being authentic with what we were actually all feeling, so that this is part of, I would say, getting a more resonant field around a trauma. And not everybody would want to do ritual like this, I guess, but we began the event with, and I do tell this story in the book, with one of my dear friends who'd been with me when we found David, who was also a shamanic practitioner. We were in front of the fireplace and she was rattling. You ever heard those rattles moving in a shamanic ceremony? I mean, it's just incredible. And there were probably 30 people present. And when it got to a certain high pitch of energy, I had a bowl, this antique bowl from China. David collected these amazing specimens. And this one had a little chip out of it. When it got to a certain peak, I just took the bowl and I smashed it on the hearth. Mm. And I can just feel it as I tell you the story now. It's like the whole, in a way, it was saying in metaphor, there are no pieces of this that are going to go back together again. You know, this is something profound has been shattered. There will be, hopefully, a reemergence, you know, ultimately a thriving, as you talk about. But for now, it's the shattering. And you be with that. And then people had a chance to come forward and be with whatever emotion they had. And for some, it was just raw anger. And for some, it was enormous grief. And for some, it was fear. And for some, it was some combination of all of those things.
Yeah.
After they would speak, and they would, it was so powerful. They would take a cedar branch that was, we had cut these little branches in front of the fireplace. This is a tradition that comes from the indigenous cultures that Michael has used, and then offer the cedar bow to the fire and a blessing for David. And there were many different events, I would say, that I did in the early days like this that were part of saying, whatever you're feeling is, and whatever I'm feeling is okay. It belongs, you know, don't isolate with this. Like, come into community and together we can maybe find, you know, a new resonance.
Yeah. One question I'm dying to ask you, Suzanne, is, you know, you've hit on so many of the, for lack of a better word, just essentials of trauma recovery. Did you already know this, or, you know, through your secular studies and life experience, or did you have to go out and learn it?
Well, that's what I had learned and was teaching in the work I do. The work I do and had done with women was around the trauma, what I call and is called developmental trauma. So not necessarily the, you know, what sometimes people call the capital T trauma. I don't actually necessarily make those distinctions. I think we want to say anything that overwhelms a nervous system is a trauma. And so that is the work I've been doing already. So I understood some of this intellectually, let's just say. I had never been through this kind of trauma personally.
Well, I love that definition of trauma, because I hadn't thought of it that way, but that's right on, that's, it's the nail on the head. So it sounds like through your coaching and your leadership training that you had done internationally, you had a lot of the a kind of a working knowledge of these things, but now you had to put it into practice yourself with what some might call it a capital T trauma. But you're right, whether it's a capital T or a little t, like you say, anything that overwhelms the brain's amygdala and sets you into the fight, flight, freeze, cortisol response, that's trauma, any way you slice it or dice it.
That's right. And so, you know, even for example, like where this started to become apparent to me was in the work I was doing with women. Let's say, for example, a woman goes to, you know, the same pattern starts to happen where she goes into a meeting with other powerful men. And every time a powerful man challenges her ideas, she collapses. So what is that? What's actually happening there? And that, you know, and usually we can trace it back to something earlier in the childhood, but that part of her that just shuts down ends up, of course, having huge ramifications in how she is in her life. And the very first thing is to notice she's doing it, to notice that, oh, that's what I'm doing, to have enough of her prefrontal lobe engaged, you know, to be able to witness it. And then the work of self-soothing to be able to settle, because immediately, as you know, once that amygdala gets hijacks the brain, you know, you're on that train to that station you don't want to go to and you can't get off until you get there.
Yeah. So,
got to do some soothing in between there.
Yeah. But I think that you were fortunate in so far as you did have a lot of working knowledge, because the whole point of this podcast is that trauma it hits us all at some point or another. And there's no rule that says you only get one. You can get layers of trauma. But the whole point is that the skill set for trauma recovery, while they're so essential, are not taught in the school. And so in a roundabout way, you learned an awful lot of the complexities of trauma, which, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was of practical assistance to you now that you were dealing with your own. Is that fair?
That's absolutely fair. But what was interesting was I can't say that this is why I think it's important you're doing the podcast you're doing and we're talking about this now, because in the moment, I didn't have my textbooks out, you know. My first book goes into a lot of, I'd written the manuscript, but it hadn't been published yet. But it wasn't like I was living from some academic thing. It was like something was installed in me or it wasn't, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm very grateful for what was both already present and the ground that I could count on, but also, and this is You Make Your Path by Walking, the title of the book, but also what I grew through going through this, like the resilience that I did not have before that I would say I have now.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the title, You Make Your Path by Walking. I'm sure you're asked, you know, and will be asked when your book is actually released. Where did the title come from, and what is the meaning and depth behind the title?
Yeah, well, the title is from a poem by Antonio Machado. He was a 20th century Spanish poet, actually. Beautiful poetry. I am a lover of poetry. I have been for decades. And this particular poem I already knew and loved. And it's that line, you make your path by walking. Actually, the actual line, let's see, traveler, there is, let me just read you this, okay?
It's sure, like please.
Short stanzas from a little longer poem, but I do have part of this in the book. Traveler, your footprints are the only road, nothing else. Traveler, there is no road. You make your own path as you walk. As you walk, you make your own road. And when you look back, you see the path you will never travel again. Traveler, there is no road, only a ship's wake on the sea. So that had already been very moving for me as a poem, just that idea that we really are like, you're in a boat and you don't know where you'll go next, and you see the foam and the path behind, and that's behind you now, and here you are. And then I kept saying it all the time. I'm making my path by walking. It was just like a mantra for me. When it came time to come up with the book title, it felt like that is just it, because it really is saying this: when you go through this trauma like this, you will be in the darkness. First of all, don't, as much as possible, don't fight that. That's the pull, because that's that first thing I'm saying already, to not resist that you must go into the dark. But then we can learn to see in the dark. What does that mean? That means, you know, finding ourselves in the present, finding ourselves here now. What is the next step? And then the next one after that, and the next one. Because the idea that somebody must know, I know in the beginning for myself, I kept thinking somebody must have been through this before, like this, like what I'm going through. And it had a certain texture to it. It was like, I'm a teacher. I'm a transformational teacher. I'm a spiritual teacher. My husband was very spiritual. You know, I lost everything, not just him, but all my financial security. I left my community. I mean, I lost everything. I looked and looked and looked for books, anybody who would, and I can never find anything. Now, I'm not saying they weren't out there. I just couldn't find them. A part of that was me just like, someone must have made this path already. I got to figure out how. And then I realized as I lived it, it's like, no, there's a wonderful support and guidance that we can draw from, but we will make our own paths. And the key is we have to keep moving. We have to be willing to make those steps when it feels like we cannot.
Well, your point's well taken. Movement is essential. And sometimes it feels like it's two steps forward and three steps back. The term I use in my book is rinse, repeat. You take some steps and you get beyond the anger, or you think you have, and then you get beyond the denial and you get beyond the depression. And then, you know, later you revisit it, and then you know, it's rinse and repeat. It's messy. It's tough. There's no way around it. I wish there was. But ultimately,
well, this is the way around it. The way around it is through.
Yeah. You don't get over it. You get through it. Yeah. I hear you. So I'm guessing that in writing your book, that it was in and of itself therapeutic. Is that fair?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I actually, the first thing was I had the manuscript of the first book. So once I, like a year out or a year and a half out, I came back together with my co-author and we got that out. And that was published in 2016. That was enormous for me. And that was like enough. Like, that's enough. I had been journaling as I do, and I journaled as I went through this experience, but there was no part of me, as I already mentioned, that heroic part that I'm going to, you know, write a book and help everybody else was just not there. It was more like I'm not sure how I'm coming through this yet, and I'm in no position to make anything, you know, any truth for anybody else yet. And then a few years out, so maybe 4 years after he died, I was ready, and it literally took me this long. And I also know, you know, that, you know, we used to in the trauma world think that you had to go, there was a kind of desensitization where you go back to the trauma and walk, you know, go through it soon. And now we know that does not work, and that's actually often re-traumatizing. And I was very working with the therapist that I was working with and the other supports. It took me, probably 4 years till I was ready to go right back to the night of the trauma itself and walk myself through some of those early stages, which I did. I took myself away for writing retreats, and I wrote it for me. I mean, I wrote it to write myself back together, to kind of be there with myself going through what I'd gone through.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned journaling, and I'm a big proponent of what we call, at least in my book, I call it sitting in the fire, meaning trauma recovery is never a solo experience. I've never seen anybody say, you know what, I got this all by myself and I'm going to recover from a horrific trauma. You always have to reach out and accept the help of others, because there's an awful lot of people that are willing to help. But you can't bottle it all inside. You got to get it out. You mentioned there two things. You mentioned the journaling and also a therapist. And that's really important, whether it's a therapist or a trusted friend. I think a trauma coach or a therapist is really ideal, because these folks are really highly trained in the whole process. But by having this conversation, what hopefully people are getting is that trauma hits us all. No one's going to, you know, get out of this life experience without it. They don't teach us trauma recovery in school, and yet it's an essential life skill. Alcoholism, workaholism, drugs, addiction, all of that are symptoms. The underlying issue is unresolved trauma. And we've got to have more conversations like this and open up the wounds and properly address them and dress them so that they can heal. That's what this whole thing's about. Those are some of the things I'm getting out of what you were saying.
Yeah, mostly summarized, actually, Randall. And I mean, I think this is why you do what you do, why I do what I do, because this is the issue of our time. I mean, not that it wasn't a before, but I'll just say we're still coming out of the COVID trauma. And that is a huge trauma that we have collectively, globally gone through. And there's no way that we get through into what I think we're in, the sort of evolutionary, the churning waters of an evolutionary up-leveling, potential up-leveling.
Yeah.
Always, you know, there's a kind of trauma in that change process. And so really helping individuals and collectives actually work through trauma right now is super important.
Yeah, absolutely. And the beauty of it is that by having these conversations, by writing the books, by reading the books, by having open discussions, it's kind of a win-win. It's therapeutic. At least for me, it was therapeutic writing my book, dealing with my thing. You just shared that it was therapeutic and helpful for you. And it's also helpful to those who are on the other end of things. And it's just it's a really wonderful kind of win-win. You know, so many people want to, you know, be brave and tough and macho and all these kinds of things. And that's part of the problem. That process simply doesn't work. It never really has, never really will. And the science is getting so good that by having these conversations, it helps people get back on their feet. So I'm curious to ask you, one of the chapters of my book is experimentation, where you kind of try out different things to get back on your feet. What other things helped you in your whole journey?
Yeah, well, I'm going to come back, first of all, just to the importance of community. Mm-hmm. So loving connection, and that I would just say to your listeners is really key. However you find that, it could be a few trusted friends, it could be maybe your family, whoever is around you. Like, the loving community is super important, and that was a stabilizing factor for me as things unfolded. I was also very paced myself in, because I had, as I mentioned, this requirement to just do a lot of stuff. I had to close his business, you know, meet with creditors, debit, you know, people that he owed money to, deal with banks, try to sell the property. I mean, there were a million things I had to do. But I already had a set of very strong personal practices. And this is probably the key thing I would say for anybody, if you don't have them, you know, to get that, which means how I started my day every day was a given. And the very first thing I would do each day was, and it started the second day after he died, I'd wake up and you come up out of the unconscious and it's like, this can't be my life. It, you know, as I already said, this cannot be my life. Not possible, but it is my life. Okay, then that's just, you know, darkness comes around. And I would just force myself to sit up on the side of the bed, put my feet on the ground and say, okay, I am grateful to be in this body, to be in this life. May everything I do today be a blessing. May this life be a blessing. You know, David couldn't be there. I could be here. Here I am. I'm in my body. I accept this. Now, a lot of the time I didn't feel that. I didn't feel like it was a blessing, but it was a ritual I did. And that got me moving. That got me, you know, getting upright from being horizontal. Mm. And then I had an exercise practice. So I always moved my body because so much of what's going on is going on in the body. And I was just, didn't feel like going for a run. I went for a run. I didn't feel like it. I went for a walk, but I always made sure my energy moved. And then I had a long-term meditation practice and I would do my meditation. And so those kinds of practices where I kind of called myself to myself every day were a really important piece. And then, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that you're just nailing it in terms of what the science says. The grounding practices, deep breathing, it goes by a lot of names, meditation. That the science from Salazar or out of Harvard is so, right, you know, nails right. It in terms of these are very simple things. People sometimes dismiss it because it is so simple, but that's a mistake. It's very, very powerful. And also exercise, we wake up some mornings and just say, yeah, I don't want to do that. And that's doesn't matter. If we're really serious about healing and moving forward, exercise of one kind or another is really important. You're really nailing those fundamentals of trauma recovery and getting back on your feet. So I just wanted to acknowledge that what you're saying is right, exactly, correct. So yeah go ahead. Right.
Yeah, and I certainly know the neuroscience around it also, which is, you know, really, you got everything we're doing is to get the nervous system settling again. You've been through an enormous trauma like that. You got to stay connected to the body in whatever ways you can. The other thing I was really deliberate about was, well, there are these waves that the emotional, when you go through a trauma or something like not maybe like what I went through exactly, but any kind of dislocation. There are the feeling waves will come and they come often completely out of the blue. Like you don't all of a sudden there'll be this big wave of grief or this big wave of anger or this big wave of terror or whatever it is. But when, and I did know this, you know, so I know to surf the waves. I know when they're coming that they will go again. And so I was very deliberate about riding whatever wave came. And if my nervous system couldn't take it, if it was too much, I had things that I would do. I had a self-soothing breathing practice, 100%, to just calm myself down. I had a call a friend. I had several women friends that were on my, you know, speed dial, so to say, that I would just say, I'm in a wave. I just want to sit with you. And they would, for example, one example of that was when I got, it was about a year out and I was starting to get back on, you know, on into the next stage of my life, let's say. And I thought, okay, I'm going to go to this little outdoor mall where there's stores and normal people. And because when you're going through trauma, of course, it feels like you can't even believe people have normal lives. It's just everything is like trauma. So I thought I'm ready now to get into the normal world. And I went there and there was just this one little thing where I saw this man reach out and hold the hand of his partner in his tender way, the way David used to do with me. And all of a sudden, I'm like completely triggered. But I know I am. And I took myself to a bench and I did my breathing and trying to, you know, long exhale and trying to get myself back in my body, but it wasn't good enough. And I called a friend. And my friend Charlene said, okay, honey, it's okay. You're all right. You're doing great. You're making your step forward. It's great that you went out and did this. Just, you know, you're a little over your head now. You've done all you need to do for today. So let's go back to the car. And I was really deliberate, and I would just say this to the listeners, to not feel like that's a failure, you know, But that's actually growing the capacity to be back in your world again in a new way. So those are some of the examples, I think.
Yeah, that's a really nice example. And what I also noticed with what you're sharing there, Suzanne, is that just the self-awareness, knowing, you know, where you are and identifying and giving, terminology to these things. Boy, you said a lot of things there. I wish I was taking notes because I would have gone back. But you're doing a really nice job just articulating that process where you feel overwhelmed. And you have the self-awareness to say, hey, this is where I am. And, you know, the thing about trauma recovery is a lot of people just mask the whole thing with alcohol or drugs or some kind of something that is only compounding the problem. What you're doing is you're dealing with it head on. I'm really amazed at just how much of this you kind of already had mastered at some level from your previous experiences and career. So all kinds of great kind of in play examples that you're giving. I guess I'm just saying thanks for sharing lots of great ideas. So as we kind of wrap up survival, how long would you say it took you to kind of go from the utter depths of despair to saying, hey, I'm okay. I'm back on my feet. I'm not doing incredible things with my life yet, but I'm at least I've gotten off the ground and I'm standing again. How long would you say that took for you?
Yeah, I kind of situate that moment, I think, was probably about a year.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a moment, I mean, a lot of had to happen very fast for me because the property, the banks were going to take it. I mean, I had to find a buyer for this incredible house, and we had to close this business and do a memorial, and I had to run the program I was supposed to run and didn't run, and all these things. So the very first, say, 8 months were just an enormous amount of movement. Then I'd moved into Seattle. I'd sold the house. I found a place in Seattle. My life was just literally like in those Tibetan sand mandalas that you've ever seen, maybe, where they do these painstaking mandalas in sand. Have you ever witnessed that?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then at the end, they just take a stick and they wipe it all out. Mm-hmm. It was like somebody, I had this perfect life and someone had just gone, like the great mystery, the goddess, whoever, wiped it all out. And I was starting from zero. And when I finally got through that, I went on a trip to Italy with my brother and his wife on a bike trip. And I remember that moment of the plane taking off, feeling like this is, and I did it specifically to be in the body of me, the biker. You know, I used to lead when I was had my phase in Italy. I didn't teach. I led bike trips in Italy, and I wanted to be with that part of me. You know, the part of me that was in Italy and that where this hadn't happened to, so to speak. And I remember that as a sort of turning. So that was about 10 months in, so that I really came back from that trip. And that was an important thing for me to create a kind of break from, to deliberately pull myself out of the life that I just started to create and do a reset.
Hmm. Yeah.
But I would also say it was many more years. It took another year to get the book out. So that was like, what was I going to do here? I'm still in the same home I was in, and this is a little studio behind the my house where I see clients here one on one, but I also do my teaching. And I slowly started to do my work again in the world. Yep. I mean, I had let my business go. You know, again, everything came down to nothing. So the rebuilding was beginning probably 2 years, maybe out. After
I got you. Yeah, I ask that because I have a friend and she lost her husband suddenly and tragically. He's also a friend. And you know, the celebration of life, the memorial service was extremely well attended and a lot of happy memories and so forth. And, I guess what I'm saying is in that situation, I don't know that the grief really was fully absorbed. We're all grieving his loss. And what I'm really getting at is you can't jump in and act as if everything's okay right away. You have to go through the process. A year is a very kind of sensible amount of time to kind of have on with someone's mind, but to bounce back a week or two later and say, hey, you know, everything's great. I really wonder if it really is, if the issues have been really dealt with.
Well, and this is you make your path by walking, because I still was showing up for things, but it was how, for example, 6 months after he died, I'd already been, had said yes to be a keynote speaker at this event called Emerging Women in Seattle, mm-hmm. with Danielle Laporte and other, you know, speakers in the women's leadership space. And I thought, okay, well, I'll be able to do that. That was in August. David died in January. And I got close to the time and I realized, oh my God, I mean, the only way I can do this is if I show up in this place, this person that I am right now. And so I remember I changed literally right in the moment. I put my notes under the chair and before I was invited to come up. And then I just stood on the stage and I went to the place on the stage where the light was and said, this is the place I might have spoken to you from. I know a lot about leadership and women. And then I went over to the other side of the stage where there was no light, right on the edge. And I said, this is the place I'm going to speak from today. Mm. And this is the raw beginning. This is the place I can talk from now when everything that I love most has been taken away. But I say this to say, you know, there are things like that to me was making my path by walking. I chose to do it, but I didn't choose to override where I actually was.
Yeah. Yeah. And looking at your book on page 19, you say this, and some of these sentences are just like, they stop you in your tracks. It's not like a book you can speed read, at least in my mind. Sometimes you just have to make a full stop and soak that up for a while. And here's one of these sentences. So much unnecessary suffering comes from resisting the change that is trying to work its way through us. I thought that was beautiful. What do you want to expound on that a little bit?
Yeah, well, that is really speaking to being with what is. I mean, this has obviously happened. I can either try to get back to where I was, or I could imagine that and create the conditions for this time to take me somewhere I've never been, or even couldn't imagine. In other words, life has dealt me this card. I would never have dreamed I could have managed it or even gotten through it, but here it is. And I would like to go through this in a way that has me somewhere like a rebirth, a renaissance, a possibility that if the phoenix does rise eventually from the ashes, of which there was no guarantee, I felt, I don't know, I could be, you know, in a cardboard box under the bridge. I just didn't know. But if it does rise, that will be because I've created the space for that change.
Yeah. And in talking to you, you've brought up what I call the dynamic duel. One we've talked about, and that's sitting in the fire, having these conversations. You mentioned the word community is obviously very important. I want to come back to that one. And then also the mindfulness, the deep breathing, whether you call it meditation or grounding, the semantics don't matter, but just understanding that to complete the trauma cycle, you've got to just deep breathing is, there's so much science to just how healing that is and grounding. But to kind of wrap up this particular episode, I have a question for you. What advice, it sounds like you have, you know, a wonderful family, siblings, and friends, a community that were very supportive. But what would you say to somebody that is going through a trauma that don't have the advantage of the community that you have enjoyed and that I've enjoyed?
Right. Well, first of all, maybe it is to look a little harder or look a little closer at who is around you, because sometimes it surprised me, the people that did also show up for me, that I wouldn't necessarily have said that, you know, I wouldn't have suggested they would have been the ones that would have, but they were there. I had to be open to that. So that's the first thing I would say, is being open to the possibility that person at work who really did reach out and wants to know how you're doing, or your neighbor who really did leave you a casserole and really does care about you, that there may be more people around you than you think, just in terms of those sort of supports. But then 100%, I think people should, if they can, get professional coaching and or therapy and or holding in some way. I mean, I would never have gotten through this, I'm sure of it, without the key supports I had to work with me.
Yeah.
Therapeutically, I saw every Sunday, I would see somebody for a kind of cranial sacral treatment, where I would just relax, and I saw someone regularly for massage. So these are all ways that if you don't naturally have a lot of people around you, you can get contact and support and know that you are not alone.
Yeah. And in fact, I wrote it down on my notes that I'm taking as we're talking. You mentioned the word movement, and it's implicit in your title. And that is, trauma hits. It's there are times where you got to take a break, but overall the trend needs to be that of movement. Otherwise, you know, you can wallow in it. I think one of the saddest observations in life is people that get to their 80s, 90s. My mom's 100, believe it or not. But you get up there and then you look back and say, you know what, I don't have much to show for it other than watching a lot of TV and a lot of drinking, a lot of masking, a lot of dodging the issues. What I'm getting from this discussion with you in the survival stage is there's a lot of movement. There's a lot of conscientious action, and there's a lot of thoughtfulness. Rather than just letting life happen to us, you're being proactive and keep moving and trying different things and identifying exactly what has been successful for you. That's kind of what I'm getting. Is that fair?
And I think there are different things at different stages too. You know, there are different, there was a stage I remember where my therapist, this is now maybe 2 years out, and my brother and his wife, again, my dear brother, were going skiing. I'm up in BC near me. And I used to be a skier, a very serious skier. I loved it. But David didn't ski. We went to Indonesia all the time. That was not our life. And she was really encouraging. She said, you know, it's your confidence body. You know, you really consider going. And I went to basically, but you know, it wasn't just like I want to go and party with my brother. It was, I want to be in the confidence body that I remember, like a little bit like I did with the biking. And that was something I could do at another stage. You know, there are different stages where I was still coming back and still not feeling my, you know, power and the possibility of the future. It was still forming itself. So I just want to name that, you know, this book is coming out 10 years after David died. This is extraordinary.
Yeah.
First of all, if someone had said you're going to write a book about it, 10 years ago, I would have said no. And secondly, I would never have said it would have taken 10 years.
Yeah.
This is really how long it's taken. And every stage has its own character, I would say.
Yeah.
This stage right now is an interesting one because I'm, like we're doing right now, I'm speaking to the experience. This in itself is the next stage of my own integration.
Yeah.
I hope, of course, that it's of service, which is why I did the book, that it will be helpful to somebody else. And at the same time, it's a way in which I am aligning with my own experience. Like I'm getting it more fully in my body, what I've actually been through, how I've been through it, and where I am now.
Yeah, well said. 10 years, that's a, you know, that's the beauty of books, is that you can... you can gain the wisdom and the insights of somebody who's been through something such as you have. It's so overwhelming, and see what the journey is in such a efficient way and such a helpful way. So we're going to talk more about the book and the Thrive Stage in our next episode, but I'm going to leave the last word to you in terms of getting back on your feet. You've shared an awful lot of wisdom. Is there anything else that you want to share with folks?
Yeah, I think I want to say the self-compassion is so key, being kind to yourself. I mean, it is a brutal, it was a brutal journey for me.
Yeah.
To make that sound good. And I'm not of the school of, you know, oh, and it was a gift and look all the things that you've become. I do feel there are offerings, and that's how I talk about them, that have come from this. But I haven't reframed it like, oh, this was so good for me. No, this was really, really, really hard.
Yeah.
And I do feel I'm somewhere new now. I have become someone who I would like to have hoped I might have become with David, right? That would have been the best scenario. I do think I'm more authentic and more whole, and I've actually found more of me and of the world through this. But I know I had to be reminded of this a lot, and so I want to remind the listeners to just be compassionate with yourself. It's not easy.
I'm so glad you said that, because you know we teach our kids, at least I'm sure you did. I did. Your parents, you know, to be kind to others. But the point is, be kind to ourselves as well. And self-care is essential, and realizing when you're overloaded, realizing when that you need to take a break or do this or do that. And just, you know, you mentioned a whole number of activities, and I'm glad you brought that up, because that's a biggie. And there's more along the lines of self-care and the book itself we're going to get into in the next episode here on Post-Traumatic Thriving.
Thanks for supporting our podcast. Be sure to like, share, and subscribe, and follow us on your favorite social media. For books, merchandise, or to donate, visit coreiq.com. Post-Traumatic Thriving is produced by CoreIQ, a nonprofit with a mission to teach the skills we all need but are not taught in school. CoreIQ and the Post-Traumatic Thriving podcast are for informational purposes only and do not provide medical or mental health advice. Always consult with your licensed medical and mental health care providers.